this week. The U.S. dollar blasted to a 12-year high, while the XAU Gold and Silver Index found support near multi-year lows. Welcome, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek. So glad you're back with us for another Muy Grande-sized show. Well, market volatility picked up in a big way this week across virtually every sector ahead of next week's FOMC meeting. Will they or won't they raise rates or at least give investors some guidance on their innermost thoughts? Well, the markets are hostage, I think, right now to the threat of the free money party might soon be over. But is this merely a case of disinflation where prices increase slower, or full-scale deflation? Could it be right around the corner, circa 2008, the credit crisis? Joining me in a discussion on this and many related topics this week, Marin Alexov, in his debut appearance on the show, who thinks the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act and related fail-safes has opened up a world of trouble for the financial markets. That's why he likes precious metals, portfolio, home insurance. On a trip to Hong Kong, he saw lines of investors wrapped around the block just for a chance to buy some gold. But only a fraction have an opportunity. He thinks this bodes well for gold demand on a forward basis. And keep your eyes on the Greek exit situation. He thinks it will eventually get out of hand, and we could see another exit by Spain, making gold essential portfolio insurance for everyone. Next up, Jeffrey Nichols makes his debut as well on the show. Jeffrey Nichols recommends that every investment portfolio must hold at least 5-10% in precious metals. Physical bullion demand is soaring, and this disconnect is particularly apparent in Asia, which consumes about 1,000 tons a year. That's 29 million troy ounces. And once the central bank rate hike scare passes, he says gold and silver will soar above current levels. Then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Partly cloudy skies remained over the precious metals sector. Virtually every market was lower this week on speculation that the Federal Reserve will hold lending rates steady ahead of next week's FOMC meeting, slated for Tuesday. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold was off about $10, ending at $11.55 an ounce. Silver dropped about 24 cents, finishing at $15.57. The XAU Gold and Silver Equities Index dropped about 2 points, down 3%, ending at 65, but well off the lows. And West Texas Intermediate dropped sharply, off about $4.50, ending at $45 per barrel, within earshot of the record lows. Meanwhile, most economists expect more dovish rhetoric from the Fed next week amid sluggish U.S. economic numbers. This week, U.S. wholesale prices for February unexpectedly dropped, the fourth consecutive month. In addition, the American consumer is tightening up their wallets and pocketbooks amid sluggish consumer confidence numbers from last month, which dropped to a four-month low, according to the University of Michigan Index. Consumer sentiment index reading was the worst since November of last year. In addition, the U.S. producer prices are falling about 0.5%, which caught economists' projections off guard on Thursday, and U.S. retail sales fell for the third straight month. Elsewhere, the Federal Open Market Committee governors will meet next week, March 17th and 18th. It's widely anticipated that the new monetary policy statement will reveal dovish comments, and dovish talk tends to lead to lower rates, which is good for the yellow metal. On the contrary, though, the U.S. dollar did blast higher this week to an 11-year high, while the euro fell to a 12-year low against the U.S. dollar. Clearly, investors are anticipating a rate hike, which makes U.S. dollars more attractive. And, of course, ECB bond buying program this week also forced the euro lower, which made the dollar and the greenback that much more attractive. Should FOMC officials shift their guidance next week to a more hawkish tone, the dollar bull and euro bear theme could extend even further. Currently, many market watchers expect the FOMC, though, to hold off their rate hikes at least till June, when the benchmark lending rate is expected to start a slow but steady climb higher at each subsequent Fed meeting. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, as predicted over the last several weeks, the U.S. dollar, it just remains the focus of investors. It caught, I think, many institutional advisors and top money managers off guard. All eyes now will be on the Fed. And will they start to change guidance to a more hawkish stance? Or will it just be more of the status quo? One very bullish development, though, signs of accumulation on Friday in the XAU Gold and Silver Shares Index, which found strong support near recent lows and lows from last year. So for the time being, though, caution is advisable. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, heavy rain and thunderheads appeared over the New York Stock Exchange this week, as investors braced for inevitable rate talks ahead of next week's FOMC meeting. Plus, weaker than expected economic numbers rattled many investors' nerves, many of whom sought shelter in cash. On Friday, the Dow Jones Industrials finished lower by 107 points, ending at 17,749. The S&P 500 dropped about 18, finishing at 20,053. And the NASDAQ fell 55 points, finishing at 48,71. U.S. stocks dropped sharply across the board on weak earnings and disappointing economic numbers. Plunging retail sales numbers were a very important component, I think, to the story. Not since 2008. The last credit crisis did retail sales experience such a prolonged slump. In addition, slowing retail sales hurt crude prices, which in turn suggest sluggish global output. Many of the top U.S. companies have significant overseas sales, and they are negatively impacted by this extraordinary dollar rally, which just makes our products less competitive overseas. Bottom line on Wall Street. Our 7-indicator index finally switched from greedy to fearful this week, and this is a sign that selling may be reaching a climax. However, I think it's a bit early to know for sure and suggest waiting to see how the markets react to next week's FOMC meeting. And if you'd like to sign up for our Alpha Stocks newsletter, where you can get all of the market predictions and our market portfolio, which is balanced and diversified, you know the risk going in and what to expect over the next year or two. It's highly scientific and statistically based. Please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account or sign up. We'd like to have you with us. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with CEO Alexoff and Jeffrey Nichols. So we'd like for you to stay with us right here at GoldSeek. Well, it's a pleasure to welcome Marin Alexoff, CEO and founder of Rosalind Capital, a seller of gold and precious metals here today. This is his debut appearance on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Why don't you give us an idea of what drew you to the sector and keeps you interested in gold and silver?
Well, on a personal level, right out of school, basically, in the late 90s, I had a choice to go either I go into equities or I go into precious metals. I chose to go into metals. I thought that was better for me because I was more into long-term deals than short-term when it comes to investments. But also, I was a coin bug as a kid. I always collected coins, international coins, Roman coins, Morgan dollars, and so forth. So I was always interested in it to begin with. And I liked the idea that you actually get something physically. That's how I got started. I started with a company and never looked back. I've never been in anything else but that. That's all I know. 17 years, all I've ever done is gold, silver, platinum, and palladium.
You are a native of Sweden. This is a country that was plagued by debt issues in the 90s. They managed the debt in a very unique way. They essentially tied it all up in one or two banks and, treated it as though it were a metastasized malignant tumor. It allowed the system to repair and to heal, and now they are not suffering the same way many of the peripheral nations in the Eurozone are suffering today. Can you give us your perspective as a native of that country and just how perhaps the EU ministers and maybe other countries could benefit from those insights?
First of all, I'm not an economist, so I wouldn't go into the details much, but one thing I can say by growing up there is that it becomes state-run, basically. And what that means is that the government takes over, and you have to be, they're very, very disciplined. That's how they manage this. It's not about, they have restrictions on everything, rates, interest rates, loans, anything. I mean, I'll give you an example. If you have a home loan in Sweden, You don't pay more than 2% regardless of what's going on. So they have capital controls in a way, and that's how they've always done it. So it is a socialistic system, but it's very, very state controlled. Even the banks are. And that's how they manage. It's that they can do a decision in a matter of minutes, just like China. There's no Congress, there's no this, there's no voting. They just do it. I think that's the biggest part of it.
Obviously, when we lost our Glass-Steagall Act and some of the other fail-safes that had been put in place during the 30s, that opened up Pandora's box, and out came this investment banking nightmare that got out of control, and then add in leverage, you know, and you just have the perfect world for disaster. That these leaders that we had in place, they weren't constrained, more concerned about bonuses, and that mechanism led to total disconnect from safety on one side of the balance to reckless leverage on the other. Let's move back to precious metals, though. And this is obviously a topic du jour for our listener base. We've had three grueling years. After a 12-year bull run, there has to be that pause which refreshes. Are we at that point, or do you think we may have further downside ahead?
The way I look at it now is the dollar is so strong. I mean, it is clobbering gold at this level. With the euro, I think it hit parity today, if I'm not wrong. You have two currencies, euro and dollar, going different directions. But, you know, at the same time, I think it's a good spot for gold. I mean, how far can the dollar really go? How low can, I think the downside of gold, yeah, we might hit 1100, test it. But I think the upside is much better due to the fact that the dollar at some point is going to start to drop, or it's going to start hurting the U.S. economy. I don't think it's in anyone's interest for the dollar to just keep going and going and going. So I think that gold is in a sweet spot here because of that. I think that the downside's limited and the upside's bigger. We could easily see this go above 1300 if the dollars just start falling again. I mean, they're talking about tightening, they're talking about raising interest rates, but it's going to be minimal moves. I don't see them doing anything big. When I started, it was 200 and some dollars. Gold's always been that way, and we do not do it for profit here. We do it for long-term safety and security. It's not about making $1 million. It's about having some protection when you need it.
There really isn't anything that has those safety aspects. You can argue that bonds have a tendency to offset some of the risk in equities. You can argue that commodities as a sector tend to balance out a good portfolio. But in the final analysis, nothing really provides that life jacket the way that the precious metals do. Do you follow the precious metals equities or just purely bullion?
We follow bullion. That's what we do. We're very focused on what the demand is globally. We do travel a lot to figure out where the next demand is going to come from. And right now, we're focused on China a lot. I just came back from Hong Kong a few months ago. And just so maybe if the listeners doesn't know, like U.S. is about 5% of the physical global market. Hong Kong is 25%. The Chinese, you know, they're growing leaps and bounds when it comes to this. And one thing they do not do, trust their own currency. So gold is pandemonium over there. I saw lines around blocks to buy gold. So anything happens, they will go there. And I think China over the next 10, 20 years is going to be a huge buyer of gold one way or another. I think demand from Asia is the key for the price of gold due to the fact that their wealth is just going to grow and grow. The middle class is going to grow, and seeing it firsthand, I just don't see it stopping.
My question to you, though, is where did you see these lines? Were you in Hong Kong by chance or Shanghai?
I was in Hong Kong. It was about, they told us the World Council for Gold, and they had some staggering numbers. I think 35 million Chinese come into Hong Kong every year on visas, and most of them try to buy gold. The numbers are staggering, and they're only letting a few. This is like only 10 or 20% of China's provinces they're allowing to travel. And they're opening up every year more and more and more. Now, as you point out, Shanghai is starting to do that as well. I think they're slowly starting to open the market there as well. So this is just going to increase. It's in their culture as well, especially when it comes to, you know, weddings and so forth, just like India. But again, I think gold is a form of protecting yourself from yourself. You have it in gold, you have tendency not to spend it. And I think that's what it comes down to. Because if you have it in your hands in gold, And if you have it in cash, you'll start spending the cash, but you're not going to spend the gold. And that's what I get from people there.
Here we talk almost exclusively about the profligacy of central bankers and the troubles systemically as a result of this widespread money spending. And then we also have the specter sort of looming in the background regarding the bail-ins and rehypothecation. So you're assaulted from every corner, aren't you? You're assaulted, A, from the bankers, and then B, in your accounts. You never know what might be going on behind the scenes there unless you've read the fine print and you don't have a margin account. And then there's also the threat of legislation being written in. But I'd like to stick, though, with Asia for a moment, because I think this, as you pointed out, is really the focal point. And we had Dr. Mark Faber, a resident of Asia, on the show last week, discussed many issues. One of the points that we were discussing was, do you think that the People's Bank of China has been accumulating more gold than the official numbers reflect? And he seemed to concur with consensus, the growing consensus, that they are hoarding gold en masse ahead of at least regional, if not reserve currency announcement. Any thoughts there?
Absolutely. I mean, they mine a lot, number one, and it doesn't leave. That we know. So it's not like it goes anywhere. So, and they're worldwide. They're snapping up anything from rare earths, metals, gold, silver, anything to get their hands up. But the biggest thing, most people, or most mints, or most, you know, they sell gold worldwide. They don't. Anything that comes out, it stays in China, and all they do is import more. They had one store, I think, in Shanghai that opened up, and they had these good bars, 400-ounce bars. In one day, there was a line. They sold 27 good bars in the first day. I mean, that gives you an idea. This is cash. They don't, they come in bags in cash. It's completely, because over there, you don't have, you don't have the, like you say here, the mortgages, all this. It doesn't exist. Everything is just cash.
Dr. Faber also addressed, you know, that for the most part, the majority of people in Asia live in the peripheral regions. And as you say, it's all cash. And remember, China is the home of the first paper currency. They have a tradition of understanding just what happens to all paper money eventually. It runs at least 1,000 years in their culture. Two forces, I think, at play. On the one hand, you have the tradition written into the culture involving, marriages and ceremonies and holidays and New Year's and whatnot. Of course, there's a traditional gold giving there. But then you also have this quiet understanding, this unspoken acknowledgement that precious metals are the one thing that will save you. As we wrap up here today, tell folks anything that you're watching that you might think is of interest.
Well, I would definitely watch the dollar. I would definitely also see what's going to happen with the rate. Also watch more outside the U.S. than inside the U.S. because there's a lot going on. And with the Europe now printing money, then Greece, I just don't see that working out one way or another. Again, I've spent time there as well. And when you have a country that refuses to pay taxes and they won't, all the pensions paid, something's going to give. And I think that the ripple effect is going to be bigger than people think. I think a lot of people have their toes in that water, a lot of banks, especially U.S. banks as well. People are downplaying it. I think that if the Greece should come out of the euro, I think Italy will look at it. I think Spain is going to look at it. And you're going to have a domino effect after that. Been a lot in Spain. I spend time there every year. I go to one thing with the euro is it works great for Germany. Don't get me wrong, but it's just another form of German ruling the financial sector. And what happens in Spain, I used to spend time prior to the EU. People had jobs. They were happier. It was cheaper for tourists. Now it's expensive. An apartment in suburb of Spain is almost as much as in Germany. There's just no way to get ahead, and people are tired of it. So one thing I think is if Greece gets out, if Greece comes out of this or gets out of the EU, yeah, they'll suffer for a couple of years of hyperinflation and all that. But after that, I think that Spain is going to look at this and say, you know what, we want our own currency. We want to go back to what we were doing and so on. Again, I think that that's something to watch for. The mentality in the southern Europe is completely different from the north. And all the jobs that they thought they're going to get by going north is just not there. People coming from other countries taking jobs, and then the people in that country gets upset. So something's going to give. This is not harmonious at all.
If we do see a domino effect, then of course we could see prolonged U.S. dollar strength, which might postpone that inevitable implosion that so many folks in this sector have been calling for. Maybe this will give us greater opportunity to accumulate the precious metals at discounted prices for a while.
It's cheap. I would, at this point, our clients buy at every dip, because at some point, no matter what happens, if equity starts suffering, a portion of that money will go to safety. And regardless of the dollar strength at that point, gold will get a portion of it. Again, with the dollar being so high and the gold being low, you know the deal. Buy low, sell high.
Exactly. And, there's another aspect here that we haven't touched on today. The frothiness of the equities sector. I mean, sure, they could run for another year or two, maybe a changing of the guard politically here in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. Because right now, if you look at it, there's nowhere else to go, really, to get any returns. But once the rates go up, you're going to see people go back to traditional things, like CDs, bonds, all that. And that's going to start, people are going to start getting out of equities to go back to more safety, interest-bearing accounts, and so forth. That will inevitably take the equities down, I believe, but you never know.
Please tell us more about Roslyn Capital, the services you provide, and any contact information you'd like to share.
What we do here is we do physical gold, and we ship, actually deliver it to you. We also do IRAs, where you can transfer or roll over IRAs into gold or silver, precious metals-backed IRAs, basically, where then your IRA is actually backed by physical gold. So that's or physical silver. That's a very good way to go as well. Call us. We send free information out. You can look it over. Any questions regarding how to do it, how to store it, how to sell it, we have it all. You can get our website, which is probably the best way to go right now, is at roslyncapital.com. And also, we do advertise nationwide, mostly on Fox News as well. I don't know if you've seen our commercial with Devane, but we do run that every hour. So if you have time to look at that, you can also call our 800 number, and let me give that to you guys. So that's 1-800-891-2341. 800-891-2341.
891-2341. All right. Well, CEO Alexoff, we're going to look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com Radio.
Thank you very much for having me. My pleasure.
It's a pleasure to welcome Jeffrey Nichols, Managing Director of American Precious Metals Advisors and Senior Economic Advisor to Roslyn Capital, precious metals economist for over a quarter of a century. Welcome, Jeffrey Nichols.
Chris, nice to join you today.
We also have had your colleague, CEO Alexoff, on the show this week. And I wonder if we could delve into, from an economic perspective, some of the benefits to holding precious metals. Most of our listeners are familiar with the diversification aspects and the safe haven qualities that gold and silver investments can offer to a portfolio.
Well, let me just say this. For most investors, we recommend 5-10% of their overall investable assets be held in the form of physical gold or gold coins. And this is irrespective of what's going on in the marketplace. At times of uncertainty, you might want to have greater exposure to gold and consider it an investment like your other investments. But I like to think of it as an insurance policy against the risks that are associated with other investment assets, dollar-denominated investments as well, because gold itself is a hedge against U.S. dollar weakness. The dollar has been very strong in the past year, but I like to think of it as other currencies being exceptionally weak rather than the dollar being strong. So hard to imagine a positive view of the dollar given the state of the U.S. economy and the type of monetary policy and fiscal policies that we've run here in the U.S. in the last several years.
Your concept of an insurance policy I find appropriate, and this is something that we in the West, for quite some time, we've had currency stability, yet from the perspective of history, this is not the status quo. Currency volatility is the norm. We, I think, as a society, have a higher propensity to be blindsided by a potential currency disruption, something that very few people have prepared for. But there's another component to this story, protection from inflation. Now, while that is tied to the currency, it also has some real-world, everyday aspects that everyone is facing.
I think that it's hard to believe that the consumer price data that we see for the United States and most likely for a number of other countries is really that accurate when we, as you say, when we go to the grocery store or when we go on a vacation and take an air flight or when we pay our kids' tuition at college. It seems like the cost of living is rising much more rapidly than one would suspect from the official data. So the first thing I would say is that the data are probably inaccurate at best and don't reflect reality at the current juncture. As I said, it's hard to believe the numbers when we look at our own spending power.
You know, I've done some of my own due diligence here, and I've recalculated the CPI. And what you notice is that the government weights the housing aspect very heavily, and that has a tendency to deflate expenses. But the problem is it just doesn't reflect our real-world purchasing power very well. And then, of course, there's the component of the oil sector implosion we've seen, which has had supposedly or will have a ripple effect through the economy, lowering prices. Again, other than at the pumps, that just hasn't been the case yet. So tell us what else you're watching now, topicality that you feel is pertinent to the precious metals.
Let me go back to the insurance aspect. As I said, I like to think of gold and silver, for that matter, as insurance policies against the risks associated withholding other investment assets or bank accounts or dollar-denominated assets of all sorts. And just as you hold life insurance to protect your family or homeowners insurance in case your house has a disaster, you hope never to collect on those insurance policies because they mean you're suffering in many other ways. And it's the same thing to some extent with gold. We hope never to see the day when gold has to serve as an insurance policy. You know, you shouldn't be disappointed because gold hasn't performed well in the last few years. In a sense, you should be glad that it hasn't, because if it had, there might be a lot of other things going on that we wouldn't be very happy about. Seeing a lot of flood damage
right
on the East Coast.
Isn't that true? And not to mention the Gulf. We have been lulled into complacency as a society, so 5 to 10% sounds like an excellent ratio, and even higher depending on your personal situation. Well, anything else that you'd like to share with the listeners today?
Well, I think it's important to state that my views on the long-term outlook for gold are extremely positive, very bullish. I think that gold will, over the next several years, rise to a multiple of recent prices, and that anybody who buys gold with a long-term, multi-year scenario will be very happy a few years down the road. I think that in the near term, gold prices, in a sense, are at a bargain. But that doesn't mean we might not go lower before we ultimately go higher. The gold market in the last few years has been characterized by selling of gold-related instruments and the gold market of late has been dominated by selling by institutional speculators and traders, and This means mostly commodity funds, hedge funds, and other instruments issued in the interbank market or the interdealer market. We've seen gold sold every time it's tried to rally. There's been selling by this group of large-scale financial institutions that are speculating in a whole variety of markets, and they're speculating in the gold market from a bearish point of view. Every time gold tries to rally, we have a big influx of selling, much like we've seen in the last few weeks. But meanwhile, physical demand for gold, that is demand for the real thing, not paper-related gold assets, but physical gold demand has been on the rise for a number of years now. And much of that physical demand is coming from the Asian markets, India and China in particular, which are the world's largest national gold markets. Demand each year in each of those countries is between 800 and 1,000 tons. And that goes on fairly regularly with consistent buying month after month, year after year, as these countries have become wealthier, their gold propensity has grown stronger. And this is gold that's moving into what I call strong hands. The buyers, whether they're private households or investors or the central banks of these countries, they're buying with a very long-term perspective. And they're not going to be eager sellers when the price rises $100 or $200 or even $300, $400. That gold isn't going to come out of these countries. And we're going to find investors in the Western financial markets in the United States and Europe bidding on gold to much, much higher prices as a consequence. So I like to think of the long-term outlook as being exceedingly positive, while the near-term outlook remains somewhat uncertain. But from a long-term perspective, today's prices are a real bargain.
No, it's well said. And I like and appreciate your thought with regard to the longer-term focus. If someone purchases shares of Netflix or Tesla Motors, who knows if those shares will exit their account through either a sell stop or a market order in the next few days, weeks, or months. But these folks, particularly in China, have a voracious appetite. It's insatiable year after year, regardless of price. It's quite a positive that with the 3-year sell-off, their appetite has actually increased. The herd tends to shun markets that are declining. That's not the case, as you point out, in India and China, which combined consume over half the world's bullion each year, as you say, close to 1,000 tons.
And in China, you know, the central bank, the People's Bank of China, has been actually promoting private gold ownership. It's made gold more available to more buyers across China than ever before. And I think it has a view that private holdings are, in some fashion, a national asset, even if they're not held by the central bank but are held by the private sector. It's still considered a national asset. And the Chinese, in particular, along with a number of other countries, Russia being another one that comes into this category, are wary of holding more and more dollar-denominated assets as official central bank reserves. And their central banks are using every opportunity they can to buy additional gold reserves in a struggle to reduce their dependence on the U.S. dollar.
You know, CEO Alexsov really underscored and highlighted this idea you bring up regarding perception, the perception of gold, of bullion, of silver, of precious metals in Asia, particularly in China, in India, is so different than here in the West. Eventually, we will have that sea change moment. Unfortunately, it'll likely require some type of dollar meltdown. The key takeaway point, I think, is they have the correct perspective.
Yes, well, these societies have been interested in gold for thousands of years. Their interest isn't going to go away overnight, even if the world economy performs, to everybody's liking. In fact, if the world economy grows to everybody's liking, there'll be an increase in wealth from these gold-friendly countries that will push prices much higher, even in the absence of global financial instability or other problems that typically favor gold.
You know, CEO Alexov mentioned that during his travels to Hong Kong, lines were wrapped of folks from China all around Hong Kong and retailers. And he pointed out that just a small fraction of the Chinese provinces are even allowed to travel. There's already a glut of imports into China. And now only a small fraction can travel to Hong Kong to purchase it. So what I'm alluding to here is the potential for a tidal wave of demand that could be unleashed gradually over the next few years.
Right, that it doesn't require financial catastrophe around the world. It just requires that these gold-friendly countries continue to buy gold as they have in the past, and more likely they will buy more than they have in the past because they'll have the means to do so. Well, I think one thing for certain is that stock prices on Wall Street and other equity markets around the world are overly expensive. The stock markets have gone higher and higher and higher, and by most measures are today extremely overvalued. So Wall Street is vulnerable to a significant setback, which could come at any time, and could be the catalyst that starts gold moving higher again. So I would keep my eye on stock market valuation, particularly in the United States and Europe, but in the developing world as well. And this could be the match that lights the flame.
You know, we recently had Dr. Burton Malkiel, a random walk down Wall Street, and, you know, mirrored your sentiments with regard to the frothiness, of, particularly of U.S. equities, noting historical P.E. ratios, the CAPE ratio from his colleague, Mr. Schiller, Dr. Schiller, over at Yale. There is certainly frothiness there. And I think that when this love affair with the equities, particularly U.S. equities, starts to wane, and we're already seeing signs of that, so we're getting close. We may be there now. We may be there 6 months from now.
Right. And, you know, the other thing that could trigger a start to the next run-up in gold or a long-term uptrend in gold is Federal Reserve policy. The Fed is between a rock and a hard place. It's created record amounts of new money over the last 4 or 5 years through its program of quantitative easing. It's held interest rates at extremely low levels that really don't make sense. And it needs at some point to unwind all of this frothiness that it's pushed into the marketplace. And when that happens, we just don't know what the financial environment will be like. You see, in the past couple of years, talk about rising rates in the United States, that is rising interest rates, have always triggered a sell-off in gold. And that's likely to continue. But when interest rates do begin to rise, we'll see the consequences. And one consequence will be more interest in gold as a asset, particularly amongst hedge funds and institutional investors who don't want to miss the upside of the stock market. So they're taking their cash and putting in stocks. But when they're a little more worried about equities continuing to rise, they may reevaluate the outlook for gold and start buying gold as a investment asset and hedge, just like others.
This sounds a lot like a gray swan moment. We've seen several of those recently. The U.S. dollar rally, nearly vertical. Very few of my guests correctly called that market for approaching 8 or 9 months in this rally, showing very few signs of abating. In addition, we also had a gray swan, if you will, with the oil meltdown recently. Not a lot of folks called that accurately. That, of course, sent the ruble plunging and the price of gold into the stratosphere.
Exactly. You know, one thing that's for sure is that uncertainty will remain high. And typically, markets are moved by events that come out of the blue, the black swan, as you alluded to with your comments a minute ago. Rarely do we see these things coming. In retrospect, you know, we can say, aha, it made perfect sense. But ahead of time, one just doesn't know. And that's why I like to focus on long-term investing in gold, irrespective of what we may think about the short-term outlook.
And on those words, we will wrap up the discussion today. Jeffrey Nichols, Managing Director of American Precious Metals Advisors and Senior Economist to Rosalind Capital. I wonder if you could tell us more, please, about the services you provide and share any contact information.
Basically, my firm is a consultant to major players in precious metals markets. By that, I mean, over the years, we've counted a number of central banks as clients, jewelry manufacturers, mining companies, institutional investors. We've counseled these companies on not just price prospects, but on business development, long-term marketing efforts. We've done a lot of work over the years with a number of national mints, the Austrian Mint, being one, the Royal Canadian Mint being another, who have been clients at times when they've tried to develop the market for their own coin in the U.S. and or global marketplace, and we've helped them do that. So from the point of view of your readers and listeners, it's unlikely that we have services for them. You know, we don't do anything for the retail investor. Rosalind is a client of mine. They have been almost from the beginning of their firm, and they've looked to us for help in marketing and in price forecasting and a whole variety of things. They're a great company with great leadership. The gold world is full of companies that are maybe not entirely on the up and up, and I'm very careful in choosing clients who I have confidence in, who I have faith in, who I think are trustworthy, worthy of doing business with. So, you know, I could endorse Rosalind Capital quite strongly. They're a great group of people. I do produce a periodic report on whatever I think is interesting in the gold market. It's called nicholsongold.com. And if your listeners and readers are interested in following the gold market, they might take a look at nicholsongold.com. But much of that information is also available on the Rosalind website.
Very good. Well, Jeffrey Nichols, thanks for taking time for us today. We'll look forward to hearing your thoughts again on GoldSeek.com radio.
Thanks so much, Chris. It's been delightful talking with you.
Well, last month, Chris Powell, Secretary Treasurer of GATA, the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, gave a must-hear presentation to professionals in Europe, and he joins us today with a synopsis of his comments. Welcome back, Chris Powell.
Hey, Chris. Very good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Before we jump into the lecture, the Bundesbank actually did finally receive some gold, some substantial gold repatriation. And maybe you could give us an idea what you think is going on there. Do you think the people have spoken, like in Switzerland and Amsterdam and Venezuela and other countries?
They have to suspect that world central banks are realizing that if they don't have their gold in their hands, if they've entrusted it to another central bank, bullion bank, then they probably don't really own it for practical purposes. The Bundesbank has been trying to repatriate some of its gold, or purporting to be repatriating some of its gold for the last year and a half or so, largely under pressure of a popular movement in Germany, led by people from the German Precious Metals Society. I don't think the Bundesbank has really wanted its gold back, but I think it has been trying to assuage public opinion. The strange thing about the repatriation has been that it's been so slow. I guess in the first year they managed to get all of 5 tons back. Now they announced they got 120 tons back in 2014. Of course, all of the, whatever it is, I guess, 3,000 tons or whatever it is they want to repatriate, it could be repatriated in a few weeks if anybody really wanted to, you know, put their shoulder to the wheel there. Venezuela got its gold back from the Bank of England in a few months. Obviously, the Bundesbank does not want to do this too fast. Certain observers, I think one for Deutsche Bank, said there were political difficulties for the Bundesbank in recovering its gold from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. But all these central bank gold transactions, Chris, are as obscured as they can be because central banks do not want the world and the markets to know the true disposition of their gold reserves. The secret staff report of the International Monetary Fund in March 1999, which GATA obtained a copy of a few years ago, showed that Western central banks were afraid to disclose the true disposition of their gold reserves and their gold swaps and leases, because if the markets found out where the gold really was and how short the central banks really were, the central bank interventions in the gold market would be impaired. You know, the true location and disposition of central bank gold reserves are really secrets far more sensitive than the location and disposition of nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons are not ever likely to be used, but central bank gold is used every day to rig the markets.
You know, it's an interesting mechanism that they have put in place, whether intentionally or not. I guess that's an entirely separate discussion. So manipulation, and you know, it's almost a cliche, at least in the gold crowd. There's been a lot of figures, I think, thrown around for many years. And sometimes it's hard to wrap one's mind around just what's going on. Can you give us an overview of what you see happening and maybe take it point by point, please?
For decades, Chris, Western central banks have tried to control the gold price because gold is a competitive currency with central bank currencies. It's also a determinant of interest rates and government bond prices. The central banks know they have to control gold, or gold in a free market will control them. There's a long-standing U.S. government policy to push gold out of the financial system, to de-recognize it as money, to control the price. This policy is revealed in all sorts of U.S. government documents, memorandum, tables, things like that, on the U.S. government's own internet site. Very frankly, U.S. government policy to subvert gold in order to maintain the dominance of the U.S. dollar as the world currency. The problem is you can't get the mainstream financial press to report on this because it leads to more and more evidence of central bank intervention in the markets, and eventually you realize there are no markets anymore. There's just interventions. But collecting these documents is what GATA has done. They're all in our documentation file on our internet site. This scheme is becoming more difficult for central banks because while they have created a vast imaginary supply of gold, paper gold, through derivatives and short selling and mechanisms like that, eventually the real metal that is always needed to underwrite the scheme runs out. It ran out in March 1968 when the London Gold Pool collapsed. The London Gold Pool was a public scheme of dishoarding of Western Central Bank gold reserves to hold the dollar gold price at $35 an ounce. It expired in March 1968 because the gold offtake through the London market was just too much. The Western Central Banks were losing their gold too fast. They withdrew from the London Gold Pool in March 68, and they began to gin up new methods to control the gold price with, and they settled on derivatives and gold swaps, gold leases. But this required required them to obscure what they were doing in the market. The gold pool was done in the open. The gold reserve figures back then were accurate and public. But now central banks create paper gold or underwrite paper gold. They sell gold futures and options and derivatives. This is all documented in the annual reports of the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland. That's the central bank of the central bank. It's occasionally documented in central bank announcements themselves. For example, recently the director of market operations of the Banque de France, the French central bank, has been giving speeches to the London Bullion Market Association, saying that Western central banks are managing their their gold reserves more aggressively. In September 2013, he told the LBMA that the Bank of France is trading gold for its own account and for the account of other central banks nearly on a daily basis. The fellow who founded the gold broker internet site, which sells gold, took me up on a challenge the other day. He wrote to the director of market operations of the Bank de France, Alexander Gauthier, to ask him about these speeches he'd been given about central bank intervention in the gold market. And Gauthier replied to him cordially that, oh, we never give information about our market activities. All anybody who's interested in the gold market has to do to confirm that central banks are secretly intervening in the gold market every day is to ask them. You have to ask them some specific questions. You can't ask them just, are you rigging the gold market? You have to ask them specific questions like, may we see the record of your gold trading account? May we see the record of your accounts at the Bank for National Settlements? Simply, are you in the gold market or not? If you're in the gold market, is it just for fun, or are there policy purposes here? If you put specific questions to them and they acknowledge your questions, they'll just tell you, as Gauthier told Fabrice Ristori at Gold Broker the other day, we don't answer questions like this because they don't want to give the game away. They can't expose their market interventions because if they do, the interventions will fail. Central bank policy requires deception and secrecy, and really the expropriation of investors, and that's why they won't answer questions. And actually, this is so offensive to me because it's essentially a totalitarian system. We're supposed to have democratic governments in the United States and other Western countries, accountable government, limited government, but instead we have created these institutions, unelected institutions, that create infinite money and deploy it in secret in the markets to rig the markets, and we can't find out anything about it, at least not with the cooperation of the government. You have to really dig into the archives, dig out secret governments, secret documents, and other information the governments are trying to conceal, and only then do you find out that our whole market economy is an illusion.
This is ubiquitous, this concept of our officials having their fingers in every market. There's no real price discovery. You know, it looks great on paper. You can tinker around with things and we're going to economically, but you know, that comes at a price. It seems as though if we don't have real markets, there's an end game here that doesn't bode well for the United States and frankly around the world. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, well, free markets have been one of the engines of civilization and human progress, Chris. The gold price suppression scheme's immediate victims are developing nations that can advance only by exploiting their natural resources. Every new country starts that way. The United States started that way, selling lumber and furs and fish and agricultural products. Every developing country has to start by developing its natural resources. It does not have a sophisticated banking system or technological sector. Those countries are the immediate victims of the gold price suppression scheme, the commodity price suppression scheme. But here in the United States, the center of the empire, really the originator of the gold price suppression scheme, we are victims of it too because we lose our democracy and we lose our markets. Even certain central bankers are describing central bank market rigging policy as what they call financial repression. We have lost our markets, and since we can't see what our central banks are doing, we are losing our democracy. Since central banks are empowered to create infinite money, they are now controlling in secret the valuation of all capital, labor, goods, and services in the world. That's a totalitarian system. These values ought to be determined in the open in a democratic way, preferably through free markets. But we're letting the financial unelected elite control these values, and it's a totalitarian system. Now, you mentioned conspiracy theory. In the first place, we deal with conspiracy fact. We collect documents, records, admissions from central bankers, much of this material still on central bank and government archives. that show that what we're talking about is not mere conspiracy theory. It's conspiracy fact. Secondly, the word conspiracy is completely proper here. For example, the European Central Bank, by its own admission, by the records it has posted on its own Internet site, admits that its board has met at least four times in the last 15 years or so to consider the European Central Bank's policy in the gold market. That's what the Central Bank gold agreements and their various incarnations have been about. Every time the European Central Bank has announced a renewal of their central bank gold agreement, it has been after secret meetings of the heads of the European central banks consulting in secret to settle upon a course of action and implement that policy. That is, by definition, conspiracy. When the European central bank gathers its board members to meet in secret, they don't invite you and they don't invite me. There's no public observance of that meeting at all. It's not announced in advance, and nobody's invited to the meeting. That is conspiracy. When, for example, the G10 Gold and Foreign Exchange Committee meets and gathers Treasury and central bank officials from the developed world to discuss their policies in the gold market, it doesn't announce where it's meeting. It doesn't announce when. That's conspiracy, secret gathering of government officials to decide upon and implement a course of action. So I don't understand all this sneering about conspiracy theory. Government, to a great extent, is by definition conspiracy whenever it operates in secret. But nevertheless, the documents we've collected show that we're not talking about conspiracy theory. We're talking about conspiracy fact.
This is obviously not just something that's been occurring in the last 15 years since GATA has been monitoring it, at least officially. You know, I mean, we can go back to at least 100, 120 years. You might recall Samuel Clemens. I know you're a fan of his work. History never repeats itself. It rhymes. You might recall the operations of Gould and Fisk, and of course, then the President Ulysses S. Grant reportedly manipulated the gold markets, and it led to a terrible devastation for thousands of investors and speculators. It's a theme that has been persistent for quite some time. And my guess is you'd say it's far more pervasive and prevalent today than it was even back then.
We have much more sophisticated mechanisms of market rigging today. But, you know, it goes back in the United States even a little earlier than that, Chris. If you read Gene Strauss's biography of J.P. Morgan, the original J.P. Morgan, the banker, not the bank that and took its name from him. Strauss recalls that back in, I believe it was 1862, the first big score that J.P. Morgan made in the markets in the United States was a gold corner on Wall Street during the Civil War. So, you know, cornering markets, rigging markets is really, you know, basic history in a market economy. We have to guard against it. Probably market rigging was the first thing that developed when free markets developed. But, you know, we have antitrust law, we have competition laws in order to try to maintain free markets. The problem is, in many circumstances, they're not enforced because the financial elites don't want them enforced, and they bring their political influence to bear on the government not to enforce it. And the other problem about not enforcing antitrust law is that the government itself is exempt from antitrust law. In the United States, the Gold Reserve Act specifically authorizes the U.S. Treasury Department through the Exchange Stabilization Fund to intervene secretly, not only in the gold market, but as the act was amended in the 1970s, the Exchange Stabilization Fund is now authorized to intervene secretly in any financial instrument market in the country or abroad. You can look this up. on the Treasury Department's own internet site. Go to the Treasury Department's internet site and search for exchange stabilization funds. Very candid page on the Treasury Department's internet site. The exchange stabilization fund is explicitly authorized to rig any market in secret. And the United States is not unique in this respect. In the United Kingdom, they have something called the Exchange Equalization Account. I don't think in the UK the Exchange Equalization Account is formally authorized to do quite as much rigging as the Exchange Stabilization Fund is authorized to do in the United States. But, you know, they've got one, too. From the comments that the Bank of France Market Operations Director gave to Fabrice Ristori a few days ago, where he said, oh, we never explain what we're doing in the markets. I imagine that France has a similar authorization for its central bank to intervene in markets secretly and to rig prices. They're doing it anyway, so I assume they must have the legal authority for it. So, you know, we only imagine that we have free markets here in the West. If you have a sophisticated central banking system, odds are you don't have any free markets anymore.
But, you know, manipulation has a tendency for blowback and ultimately for the pendulum to swing back in a fearsome manner.
Market intervention, suppression of markets, very often does result in shortages and rationing. That's really what led to the end of the London gold pool in March 1968. There's a funny story on the Reuters news service this week about the tampon shortage in Argentina, because Argentina has imposed a lot of foreign trade controls in order to protect its very meager foreign exchange funds left, and now there's a huge shortage of various things in Argentina, including the tampons, so that, you know, market interventions do tend to result in shortages and rationing. But, you know, they don't blow up by themselves, and when they blow up, they don't necessarily restore free markets. I am afraid that when the rig is exposed and it ends in regard to gold and other things central banks are tampering in right now, we may not end up with free markets. We may end up with more what the central bankers call financial repression. When they can't rig the markets surreptitiously anymore, they may outlaw the markets. They may impose rationing. They may impose capital controls. They may you know, take control of financial accounts. You know, the blowing up of the rig does not necessarily mean freedom. It very likely means much more repression. At least the government will come out in the open and start repressing people and repressing markets and interfering with supplies of product. But at least then, if they do that, we'll know what's happening. And I suppose that would be preferable for me to the system we have now, where many people are deceived. But yes, you know, market rigging tends to blow up, but the result is not necessarily liberation. There could be more repression.
You point out that the French Central Bank, or at least some of the officials there, intercede in the gold market on virtually a daily basis. If that's going on, just imagine what's happening with the European Central Bank and the Federal Reserve. Give us an idea on just how pervasive this is and what it might mean.
I'm sure that all the major central banks in the world, even the ones in Asia who are, you know, not necessarily great allies of the Western central banks, are certainly aware of and to some extent involved in the gold price suppression scheme. We know that the Russians have been aware of it at least since 2004. That's when the deputy director of the Bank of Russia, the Russian Central Bank, Oleg Mazeyskov, gave a speech to an LBMA meeting in Moscow, in which the only words of English he spoke were "Gold Antitrust Action Committee." Now, we've had no contact, to our knowledge, with anyone in Russia as of that point, so the Russians were following our work as early as 2004. We know that commentaries about gold price suppression by Western central banks often appear in the government-controlled press in China. So we know that, you know, China knows all about it. I surmised just after the great gold price smash in April 2013, China must have been complicit in that. Everybody had been saying prior to April 2013 that there was a Chinese put in the gold market. You could, you know, safely buy gold because China was, you know, going to be supporting the price. Well, you know, after the big smash on, I think it was April 12th and 15th, 2013, where the gold prices knocked down, I think, a few $100 in a very short time through enormous paper gold selling. Well, what happened to the Chinese put there? It obviously disappeared if there was one. The Chinese foreign exchange reserve, estimated at the equivalent of $4 trillion, long has been so large that China has been able to control any market it wanted to control by intervening, buying, or selling. So I deduced after that smash in April 2013 that China must have been at least complicit in the gold price smash back then, very possibly because they wanted to obtain more gold cheaply prior to a resetting of general world currency values. About the same time, a couple of U.S. economists who were also fund managers, Paul Brodsky and Lee Quaintance, wrote a paper. In fact, they may have written this paper even before the Chinese, before the April 2013 gold smash. Brodsky and Quaintance wrote a paper speculating that the real central bank game here was to redistribute world gold supplies more fairly among the major countries, redistributing it from the creditor nations, from the debtor nations to the creditor nations, so that the creditor nations like China would be able to hedge their U.S. dollar exposure with hard assets. Jim Rickards, who is a fund manager, a former lawyer for long-term capital management, former holder of U.S. Defense Department security clearance, and a frequent commenter in the news media, has been saying for some time now that based on his contacts and intelligence agencies and International Monetary Fund and central banks, that the game is indeed what Brodsky and Quaintance hypothesized a few years ago, to hold the gold price down long enough to allow the creditor nations, particularly China, to obtain gold cheaply to hedge their dollar exposure with, and that when, you know, China has enough gold that it thinks can hedge its dollar exposure, they will let the gold price go. They'll stop bringing the gold market, if only because the gold will be exhausted, the currencies will be devalued, and gold will make its reappearance as the financial asset par excellence, and the price of gold will be reset by agreement among central banks to a much higher level. Now, the problem I have with Rickards is that, you know, he doesn't really give attribution for all these things. All the sources he's talking about are not named. On the other hand, the guy is obviously brilliant. He has connections. He was a participant in a Defense Department war game, economic war game, I think 6 or so years ago. He's had U.S. Defense Department security clearance. He's been to a lot of places, and I know he's talked to a lot of people. I know him a little bit, and I follow his work and his assertions very closely. And while I'm a journalist and I have to suspect anybody who makes very serious assertions without giving sources by name, I think what Rickards is saying is it matches my own observations. It matches the observations of Brodsky and Quaintance, and I think it's more than plausible. I think what he's saying is probable, which means that all the major central banks are in on the gold price suppression scheme, and that they are, as Brodsky and Quaintance speculated a few years ago, working to redistribute the world's gold supplies so that the dollar creditor nations are hedged when the dollar is devalued.
It's certainly an intriguing scenario you've outlined. For instance, isn't it interesting, this skyrocket in the price of the greenback, all while the yellow metal has obviously retraced substantially from its 2011 peak. That would present a unique opportunity for a central bank which does not disclose, at least not on a regular basis, its gold reserves to accumulate en masse. Bill Murphy has pointed out here on the show that you made a special trip to China and obviously presented your outlook there. I mean, you must have a clear idea, at least better than most of us.
I've spoken a few times at conferences in Hong Kong, and I've been told that certain influential people attended. If they did, I don't know who they were. I've had no direct contact with anyone, to my knowledge, at the People's Bank of China. I have talked to certain other central banks in Asia, and even though I have to admit that most of the central banks I've asked to talk to don't even acknowledge my mail, even when I send it to International Express. But I do know, Chris, from the government-controlled news organizations in China, whose reports were cabled back to the State Department in Washington from the U.S. Embassy in Beijing. I know from those cables, which were disclosed a couple of years ago by the WikiLeaks organization, that the government of China knows all about the Western gold price suppression scheme. It is a frequent topic in the Chinese financial press, and I know also that the U.S. government knows that China knows, because those Chinese government press reports were cabled back from the U.S. Embassy to the State Department of Washington. So China knows, and the U.S. government knows that China knows. And all these documents and others are posted on Gata's Internet sites and in the documentation section. And I really urge anybody who doubts the general outline of what Gata says to look at those documents and let us know if any of them are forgeries or if any of them are being misconstrued. And I really find no one in the mainstream financial press and no one in the financial industry is interested at all in discussing those documents.
The People's Bank of China's U.S. dollar reserves are clearly a monumental vulnerability that we have here. Do you see them pulling the nuclear trigger? Would they play that card in the future, and what might that mean for the market?
Well, you know, the old, you know, saying, if, you know, you owe the bank $1,000, you got a problem. If you owe them $1 billion, they got a problem. I am not one of those people who thinks that the People's Bank of China is so smart. I think to amass a foreign exchange surplus almost entirely in U.S. dollars, I think they are just as much at the mercy of the United States as the United States is at the mercy of China. You know, Rickards has said, you know, both countries are kind of in a delicate dance here. The United States doesn't want China to dump the dollars and the treasuries, and you know, China doesn't want them to go down in value until China's been able to hedge them. So, Rickards has argued, and I've argued, others have argued that the game here is really a cooperation between the United States and China to allow China to gradually obtain enough gold and hard assets to hedge its U.S. dollar exposure against the day when the dollar has to be devalued. When that will come, I don't know. I'm sure I'll be as surprised as anybody else. But I don't think that the Chinese were so smart to you know, tie so much of their fortune into the U.S. dollar. I think they woke up to this problem rather late.
I wonder if you could give folks an idea of what it is that you see that makes this time in market history, if you will, different from, let's say, 1980 to the year 2000. You know, after a big peak in the precious metals, a lot of people have lost some of their enthusiasm. But my guess is that fundamentally, at least some gray swans for every investor to take note of.
My value, if I have any in this field, is simply as the archivist of the records, Chris, or maybe my ability as a journalist to pick up more quickly, maybe than some others do, on contradictions and consistencies. As a financial analyst, I think I have very, very little to offer the world. But you know, there are certain indications that are implied by the documents that GATA has collected, and probably the foremost among them is that there is a huge naked short position in investment-grade gold in the world. The paper gold of the world outweighs the real metal in the investment world by, you know, a huge factor. It's been estimated to 50 to 1 or even 100 to 1. Most of the investment grade gold that the investment world thinks it owns almost certainly does not exist. Now, if central banks are beginning to realize that their gold outside their vaults has probably been, you know, hypothecated and rehypothecated and compromised, and they want to repatriate it, if they realize that the dollar and the currencies are going to have to be devalued, and indeed are already being devalued, then there is going to be a move toward obtaining physical gold. And if there is a move toward physical in circumstances where there is a huge imbalance between the physical and the paper, that of course implies a much higher price for the physical. I think that will happen someday. It will happen, I don't know, maybe it'll happen when central banks lose control, or more likely when they realize they're about to lose control and they try to get in front of the gold issue by revaluing gold themselves. I think that's really what's most likely to happen, that someday we will you know, be just about to go to bed here in the West, and we'll turn on the 11 o'clock news on a Sunday night, and we'll find out that the major central bankers have been meeting in Switzerland or somewhere, and they're announcing a new currency system or a new currency valuation that involves gold at a much higher price. So these things happen every 30 or 40 years or so. Anyway, sometimes they involve gold and sometimes they don't. But I think central banks, rather than lose control of their rigging completely, will probably realize that the shorting of gold can no longer be sustained, that there's too much demand for real metal, and that gold has to be revalued at a much higher price. And central banks, I think, will want to be seen to be the ones doing it, so people think that the central banks are still in control, that the markets has not taken control. And I think that's what we will see someday. I don't know if I will live long enough to see that day. I hope I do, because that day will be, I think, a mark of a little bit of the failure of the totalitarian system. Unfortunately, I think when they revalue gold upward, it will simply be the first day of the next 50 years of gold price suppression at a higher, more sustainable level.
Interesting. And one really wonders how long that will last, because just as we saw the ruble revalue in 7 weeks' time by 100% against gold, gold skyrocketing, folks losing half of their purchasing power, there's precedent. I mean, this could happen, I think, much more abruptly than maybe a lot of top forecasters and analysts are, you know, are expecting.
Oh, yeah, major things like this have to be done overnight. You know, you can't, the fiat system cannot survive a sustained withdrawal. I mean, it'll build into an avalanche. If gold is going to be revalued substantially, it will happen overnight. Look what happened with the Swiss National Bank's repudiation of its Europeg. I mean, the exchange value of the Swiss franc for I think a little while went up 40%. There have been whole brokerage houses that have been ruined, bankrupted by this move. You know, this is disgraceful. This is expropriation. This is treachery. It's betrayal. The Swiss National Bank really almost until hours before it repudiated the Europeg, it was swearing that it would keep it forever.
Well, but weren't they really front-running, though, the upcoming ECB meeting, the European ministers?
Well, they very well may have been, and I'm sure they feel they were forced into it. Nevertheless, they were telling you, they were telling me, they were telling, you know, your broker and everybody else that, oh, no, this policy is irrevocable. We're going to keep it forever. And the people made investment decisions based on that solemn pledge. And, you know, it's another reason against central banking, at least as it is conducted in the West today, which is completely in secret by people who are not elected.
No, exactly. I mean, rehypothecation, I think, is going to be a term with many different monikers in the years to come. We've seen it pop up all over the world, beginning, I think, with Cyprus, running through Europe, and now much of the legislation from Canada, the U.S., and all around the globe has this nefarious verbiage written into it. Borrowers and lenders, everybody has the potential to wake up, as you say, and find out the terms have been changed.
Listen, there is not one nominally democratic country and not one parliament, Congress in a nominally democratic country that has any idea of the full range of interventions being undertaken right now by their own central banks. And you can't maintain a democracy when you don't know what such a powerful agency is doing. And you don't have a democracy when this secretive unelected agency can change economic values on you by 40% or 100% overnight. That's not a democratic system.
Chris Powell, as we wrap up, I wonder if you might share any parting comments that you have with listeners today. You have, you know, a wealth of knowledge, and I'm sure there might just be one or two other topics that you'd like to leave with the listeners.
I'd like to tell them to send money. We're broke. The you know, the monetary metals industry and its investors have been devastated over the last 3 years, and they were the primary donors to GATA. We are a nonprofit civil rights and educational organization. We have tax exempt status in the United States under Section 501c3 of the U.S. Internal Revenue Code. Donations to GATA in the United States are federally tax deductible for people, and we really could use a little help because our operations, other than running our mouths on the telephone, are about to come to a halt because our treasury is you know, close to being below ordinary operating expenses on a month-to-month basis. If people are if they've got anything, if your listeners have got anything left, and I would understand completely if they did not, because we don't, and they feel like helping, I would thank them for going to our internet site, gata.org, and looking for the How to Help button on the left-hand side of the page, and they can make donations by credit card over the internet or check or Bitcoin, or if they want, they can even mail cash to my house, and I promise I'll put it in our account in the bank.
Very good. Well, you know, support the good guys, and you all have certainly spent at least the last 15 years or so to try to disseminate the truth and the information that we all need. So please help support GATA.org, Bill Murphy and Chris Powell, and everything they do. We want to thank you for taking time today and look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com radio, sir.
Oh, my pleasure, Chris.
Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. A Reuters article this week confirmed a long suspected and speculated development, and that is that China would be developing and launching its own version of the international SWIFT system, which is a global banking transaction system used by most international banks in 210 countries. The China International Payment System, CIPS, or CIPS, will remove one of the biggest hurdles to internationalizing the yuan and should greatly increase global usage of the Chinese currency by cutting transaction costs and processing times. It will also put the yuan on a more even footing with other major global currencies like the U.S. dollar. As the SIPS system is expected to use the same messaging format as other international payment systems and make transactions run smoother. China's yuan became one of the world's top five payment currencies in November of 2014, overtaking the Canadian dollar and the Australian dollar, according to Global Transaction Services Organization, SWIFT. This is a big development for firms operating in China, as their banks can now access a wider network for settling payments in yuan, which leads to lower costs. Back in December, I commented that there were calls to expel Russia from the international SWIFT system, and on December 26th, it had been announced that Russia's central bank was going to be launching its own SWIFT-style system sometime in 2015. Clearly, BRIC nations are taking seriously the need to control their ability to regulate international financial transactions. The Chinese system is expected to be in place come early September or October. That's about the same time frame as the next international conference on SDRs, or special drawing rights, which is about the same time frame as the Apple Gold Watch should be in high gear in Asia and China. Lots of things happening this year, both symbolically and factually, relative to financial independence the world over. The battle for economic independence and autonomy the world over will continue to escalate throughout 2015 and beyond. It is a trend that is unstoppable. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.